The moon's brightness has guided mankind through the night since before we were humans. But literally and figuratively, our moon also has a dark side. In the last couple of years, we've seen renewed interest in returning to the moon, and a point often raised is that there's not much purpose served by short trips to collect more rocks. If you're going there, you should be setting up shop in a fairly permanent way, and not just some small base for strictly scientific research. What we imagine using the moon for as our space industry develops isn't some small base, but a vast network of industrial facilities housing thousands to millions of people who live there for years at a time, if not permanently. We looked at some of these back in our episode, Industrializing the Moon. Such scenarios are still rather far off, not something we'd see for decades at least, but it raises the concern of how such colonies might develop over time and interact with each other, and that will be our focus for today. We don't see many deep looks at the moon. It's always a waypoint in science fiction, a place we see in its early stages, but ignored afterwards, in favor of focusing on distant planets. Now, we haven't been back there in a while, but we have been there. Because of this, it's lost some focus in science fiction, and doesn't get the consideration it used to, the same as how a lot of sci-fi was set in Antarctica or the deep seas in the early 20th century, but less so nowadays. That's a pity because whether it's the moon, the deep sea, or the Arctic poles, these are still very unexplored places that have played a big role in humanity's development, and will play an even larger one down the line. I particularly enjoyed Andy Weir's new novel set on the moon, Artemis, and much like his earlier work, The Martian, it has a good amount of hard science in there, but also has a compelling character as the protagonist. And it really gives us an immersive look at a moon base that many hundreds of people call home, and how a culture can arise there. That human part of the equation is our major focus for today, so it seemed a good choice for our Audible Book of the Month. So when it comes to colonies on the moon, when the place starts hosting thousands of people, there's still not much room for conflict. The moon may be a lot smaller than Earth, but it still has a total land area in between Africa and Asia in size. Similarly, until the place has a net population of at least a modest-sized country, all those various bases are going to be utterly tied to Earth. This isn't some distant colony, after all. It's one where even our early spacecraft only needed a few days to reach, and where light lag is minimal enough to allow real-time communication, just with irritating pauses of a couple seconds. There's no isolation requiring a need to be autonomous and self-sufficient, like interstellar colonies have. And to get colonized to the point that you have a big population on the moon, it's got to be exporting things or providing services, giving it a very tight trade tie to Earth. We have to put ourselves into a time when the population is at least a few million, and that also means that it's not really Earth and the moon either. Such a setup strongly implies a huge orbital infrastructure around Earth, and probably the moon too, with lots of objects in the space between the Earth and the Moon, cislunar space. The whole point of the Moon, in terms of developing a serious foothold there, is to supply vast amounts of raw materials for building up that orbital swarm around Earth and extending our foothold to other planets. So if you've got millions of folks on the Moon, enough to contemplate real conflicts with each other or Earth, it's because you've been supplying that construction material for space expansion, and could easily have hundreds of millions of folks already walking off Earth. If the moon is big enough to have bits of it thinking about sovereignty in a serious way, it's because expansion into space has truly kicked off, and there's probably other smaller colonies on other planets and in the belt, plus vast amounts of space habitats around Earth. Now there's a chance that the whole moon might rebel as a unified group, and could do so at a smaller population than millions of people, but it doesn't seem very probable. If there's to be major industry on the moon, that's industry many folks will want to get involved in, and no one will be in a position to monopolize that in the current international setup, or anything likely to evolve in the near future. If it's attracting serious industry, there's the economic aspect, which is cause enough. But the moon would include concerns of prestige and security, too. This tends to imply early colonization will either be a vast, unified international effort, in which case it's unlikely to be a place where residents are suffering vast oppression or neglect, or it's likely to be a collection of various separate facilities with separate founding entities and motivations. Neither is very likely to foster a moon-wide rebellion. They might have many shared concerns, but we'll probably be looking less at an emerging lunar culture and more at numerous subcultures. You'd have folks living in lava tubes and others living in craters, some of which are small and some of which are the size of major nations back here. Geographically, unlike Earth, the poles are particularly attractive places to live, largely because we do want the ice there, so you've got concentrations of bases in the north and south. You've also got a light side and a dark side divide. The moon's dark side isn't dark in the classic sense. It gets the same sunlight as the rest, but we can never see it from Earth, and they can never see us. That makes it a great place for telescopes and receivers for long-distance transmission or power beaming. The dark side of the moon is the one place in this solar system you can build a massive laser system for pushing spacecraft or blowing up rogue asteroids that cannot be pointed at Earth. For the folks on the dark side, Earth is never visible. For the folks on the light side, it hangs there all the time. The moon rises and sets on Earth. It waxes and wanes. But on the moon, the Earth does not rise or set, though it would wax and wane, and it would be a good deal brighter to them than the moon is to us, with it more or less hanging in the same part of the sky all the time, though which part of the sky would still vary depending on where you were on the moon. Days on the moon last a month. The sun will just slowly crawl across the sky. No air, so no blue skies. No pastel sunrises. When it sets, the night lasts for a couple weeks, but Earth is still there, very bright. I think this would have a pretty big impact on people. When we talk about distant colonies going independent, they almost have to from day one because Earth is so far away. But it's only a couple seconds of transmission time away from the moon, and not a long flight either. So Earth is never far away nor out of sight and mind, particularly for the light side. Folks living on the dark side, or lava tubes at least, would not actually see humanity's homeland constantly hanging overhead, and that might make a difference. To the folks living in the crater domes or in the moon's own orbital network, or living a nomadic existence on regolith extraction tractors rolling around the dusty surface, Earth is right there, a lovely, fertile paradise overflowing in water, in contrast to their bleak and sparse landscape, always visible, and just a phone call away. Unlike every other colony humanity has ever created, every colony we will ever create after that, far away on distant alien worlds, the moon will still be in that window of time and space where sons and daughters can migrate there and still call home. There's very different types of bases on the moon, very different lifestyles for those living there, different priorities, different founding cultures they are still connected to. Different cultures will emerge on the moon, but they may differ from each other more than from their founders back home. In that respect, a conflict between two entities on the moon seems more likely than with someone back home, and it is likely to be someone, not the whole Earth. For one thing, that would be suicidal. Whatever sci-fi says about having a strategic advantage from fighting at the top of a gravity well, as we saw in our episode on planetary invasions, it isn't a very big advantage, albeit moon bases enjoy a lot of other advantages over an orbiting fleet. The other thing is it isn't you versus Earth. It would be you versus Earth and that massive orbital infrastructure between you and it. Various habitats and industry in orbit around Earth and in cislunar space are probably going to outnumber the folks on the moon all by themselves. After all, the moon would have grown by providing the raw materials to build those areas up. Just as an example, the moon is likely to have mass drivers and railguns for launching cargo, and such a thing could be adapted to launch kinetic missiles back at Earth, But because the moon is tightly locked in orbit of Earth, any mass driver built for that is always aimed in the same direction, down a single corridor that you can defend, and is built to sling large payloads into orbit of Earth. That's not an ideal weapon. Alternatively, Earth probably would have its own orbiting mass drivers, and odds are many of these would be purpose-built for defense, be it an attack or a breakout of Kessler syndrome, particularly since even a minor conflict in Earth orbit could result in that exponential collection of debris without them. Now, when we say conflicts, we are not necessarily talking about a war or violence or even necessarily hostility. In practice, in current times, that's often a losing route to gain an objective anyway. A lunar economy is one that's going to be very dependent on trade, and while the sailing ships of the past could convert to warships or pirate or smuggler ships very easily, that's a lot harder with spacecraft. Not the warship part. As we often point out, an unarmed spaceship is an oxymoron. But you can't just sail over the horizon and raise the Jolly Roger and do some privateering. No vessel is moving around cislunar space with any secrecy as to where it is or what it's been up to, and smuggling is rather tricky when every port of call has specific airlocks everything moves through. There are some advantages the moon enjoys strategically, though, as I mentioned, and one of those is airlocks. On the moon, from day one, every place is a bunker, every door is a vault, and odds are, even the individual rooms in someone's home have sturdy airtight doors and backup air supplies and carbon scrubbers. Every room has some little monitor built in, watching for little dips in air pressure or changes to air chemistry. Most of the habitats are likely to be at least partially underground, quite probably under meters of lunar regolith, and possibly sporting a point defense system for blowing up micrometeors. Consider the effect that has on one's mindset, and that could spill over to other areas. Early settlements aren't likely to have been big on privacy either, so you could easily have very security-conscious civilizations emerging there. There's also some ready-made soldiers hanging around, in at least three types. First off, you've got the mining crews. Those folks will be very used to wearing spacesuits, which convert easily to wearing battle armor, and using explosives and mining equipment. In other words, the skill list you need for raiding or invading another moon base. Second, you've got all those ships. And it's not that most modern vessels tend to have a Navy mindset because so many of the crew are former Navy. It's that the entire Navy mindset more or less evolved from what the norm on ships tended to be. Ships are not run democratically, and you don't quit mid-voyage or decide you don't feel like following orders today. And there's not much reason to think a spaceship would be any different. As of nowadays, two-thirds of current or former NASA astronauts are current or former military, and the ratio is quite high in other space programs too. There will be a lot of ships coming and going from the moon, and a lot of orbital facility security forces at the various ports, and even those who don't have a military background, are going to be a pretty easy conversion to troops if you need them. Third, you've got those nomadic miners we mentioned in passing. You can make a pretty good analogy for the moon with the old colonies and city-states of classical Greece. The only difference is all those craters or lava tube cities have no real interest in hoarding random large bits of territory. There's no farms or forests producing a regenerating supply of goods. All that regolith has plenty of materials in it we want, but you don't set up a shop on a chunk of it and keep steadily supplying a harvest. You harvest, and it's done. You've also got low gravity and no air resistance, so you can make some very big harvesters that sweep over places, and get what they want and move on, possibly never stopping. You could get ones big enough to house a whole clan, or caravan collections of smaller ones hoarding families, as opposed to farmsteads, though you might have some of those too, domes growing food that don't move around. For those harvesters, they just head from place to place collecting minerals and mapping spots and stopping to trade in their haul for other supplies, a nomadic existence. Now, just because nomads have traditionally been amongst the most elite fighting forces in Earth's history doesn't automatically make them that on the moon. But like the miners, they'll have to be comfortable getting in and out of spacesuits and operating with less safeguards in a hostile environment. What's more, they are a group most likely to have weakened ties to entities back home. They trade with their neighbors and move around, which means they are also a handy way to sneak spies, saboteurs, or Trojan horse invasion parties into various bases. They are also likely to be the group folks go to who want to leave their own base, possibly the home for those who aren't very welcome in their own habitat anymore, but can't go back to Earth. It wouldn't be hard to imagine such a group having less than friendly relations with a lot of the bases they visit for trade. In short, though, the moon is likely to have an advantage in terms of living places already being rather fortified, and much of its workforce being easily converted to military personnel, likely many of its industries too. It would probably be the biggest manufacturing hub off Earth itself, and factories of the future are likely to be a lot more versatile and faster to switch over production on. Plus, it is the most obvious place to be locating defense industries for space. Just because some group has a lot of defenses and weaponry doesn't mean they're hyper-aggressive, but in general, if you've got a lot of muscle, muscular solutions to problems tend to be a bit more attractive. In any conflict, peaceful or not, you inventory your tools and resources and those of your opponents and look for an edge. And again, it need not be violence, be it outright warfare or various covert activities. You might funnel it into sports instead, much as the Olympics was intended for. And since exercise is going to be vital on the moon to avoid muscle and bone loss, and since you have many new or different sports there with the low gravity, you might have fairly active sports leagues fairly early on. Another potential economic boost for the moon, such games might be popular to watch back home. Of course, such things can cause intense rivalries or feuds too. We did have one war ignite over a soccer game in 1970, one of those wars that tends to be only remembered for being surprising or confusing, like the US-UK Pig War of 1859, or my own state's war with Michigan in 1835. I should note, though, that while such events tend to be remembered little, and mostly for how embarrassing or weird they seem, they were usually quite important to the folks doing the fighting, or just the final straw in rising tensions. Often such events were life and death issues for the folks there, and were simply seen as minor to third parties outside, or in distant capitals. While the moon will always be a quick phone call from home, such things will be a factor in more distant colonies. And even then, close or not for communications, a remote colony of a few thousand folks having a motorist dispute with their neighbors is still likely to be seen as a minor and trivial event by whichever major nation-state of tens of millions of people is their sponsor back home on Earth. That alone could be the sort of thing that triggered a move for independence. If you feel like your home is being neglected by the empire it's part of, one that treats it as a footnote and doesn't really get its problems, that's cause enough to seek self-rule. There need not even be any oppression, or blatant neglect or malice on their part, or even the perception of it, just the feeling that they don't understand your needs and aren't trying hard enough to, or are even just incapable of it. A delayed shipment of repair parts for carbon dioxide scrubbers, or an unwillingness to pay the license fee for an improved design for one, would seem a trivial thing to revolt over, but it wouldn't be to those revolting. Now, how would such a conflict occur? Obviously, that's impossible to say. As we note in our Space Warfare series, military tactics change with each conflict and new bit of technology, and even a very minor invention can utterly shift the dynamics. However, if it turns violent, there's the obvious option of nukes. The moon has uranium too, and it's quite likely to be a big chunk of their economy. Absent fusion or solar power satellites, fission is your obvious power source on the moon. The waste is easily disposed of, and it's easy enough to build a reactor there, whereas fossil fuels, wind, and hydroelectric are all off the table. And anywhere away from the poles and their peaks of eternal light, you have those two-week-long nights which make lunar solar power difficult to use. Additionally, while we are reluctant to use atomic rockets on or near Earth, they are one of the best ways to make interplanetary ships move, and also ideal for mining missions to the asteroid belt. The moon is likely to have a thriving industry for mining and enriching uranium, It's also trivial to build a missile when you have rocket parts all over the place, and those rockets don't need to get as fast as on Earth to circle the globe or fight through an atmosphere. On the other hand, they're much easier to shoot down without that atmosphere in the way, and moving at low speeds for suborbital trips. Not to mention that the moon will almost certainly have a bunch of orbital facilities, with intercept systems designed to hit superfast targets in the first place, to deal with micrometeorites and various debris or garbage lost by ships. Also, again, especially something as hard to conceal as a nuclear device, is difficult when entry is through airlocks, not thousands of kilometers of minimally guarded borders and coasts. You might be thinking that when we're talking about nukes, you don't actually need to get it into the base. But remember, most will be underground in whole or part, and due to the low gravity and lack of atmosphere, it's very easy to pile several meters of regolith on top and around your base. Nukes are quite powerful, but not magically so. A low kiloton device detonating a few hundred meters from your base has no normal shockwave as there is no air, but would not blast through a meter-thick section of stone at even that short a distance. It's also unlikely to get the whole facility, even if it cracks it. After all, as we mentioned, odds are very good every single room has an airlock on it. Which is not to say that they'd be an ineffective weapon, hardly. But they aren't going to be as effective compared to back on Earth. There's no fallout, there's no radiation concerns, and no extensive killer atmospheric shockwave as everyone already lives in an airtight, radiation-shielded bunker. But it's still a weapon of mass destruction, and it still has all that political fallout. At least in modern civilization, whoever deploys a nuke first is almost destined to be viewed as the bad guy in any conflict by outside parties. Odds are good a lot of lunar colonies would have a nuke if they wanted it, and they only get easier to manufacture as automation improves. But many would likely view it as merely a defensive weapon, an ace up the sleeve you can use to keep the enemy from escalating things too far. For those purposes, you don't even need one, just credible rumors that you have them, and the basic capability to make them. In that context, we obviously can't rule out nuclear conflicts on the moon, but they wouldn't seem particularly likely. We can pretty much rule out chemical weapons. They are not very useful in an environment where every breath of air is filtered and monitored. And biological weapons are not much better. And those carry an even worse stigma than nukes or nerve gas, too. You're almost guaranteed to become a pariah state if you use them, and the conditions there make them hard to use and even harder to conceal the source. There's going to be logs of every visitor after all. On the other hand, the moon is exactly the sort of place where you keep your more dangerous biological laboratories, and it is a lot easier to sneak in a small vial of plague, concealed as the inkwell of a pen, or even just a tiny capsule implanted in someone they could remove. Viruses are tiny and reproduce. You technically only need one copy of it. You also don't necessarily need to sneak it in. You could probably have a tiny dart missile drone that could fly into the side of a base and burrow in and be guided to a place it can infect. Still, probably not a likely attack vector. What would seem more likely, beyond non-violent conflicts like trade wars, sanctions, blockades, or proxy hostility through sports, would be more like small raiding parties of infantry trying to sneak in through boring tunnels with mining equipment, or commando teams who got into that port and attacked there or concealed weapon components while traveling innocuously, or even made or acquired them on site. Infantry is more viable there too, as it's likely to be a lot of tight corridors rather than a place you deploy tanks, let alone aircraft, which, for obvious reasons, aren't likely to be a major chunk of any lunar arsenal. Drones might be quite common too. We discussed those recently in Attack of the Drones, and while the flying kind might not be common, we'd certainly expect a lot of ground rover and rocket-propelled drones to be on the moon for normal peacetime usage. So, lots of options and scenarios for how colonies might emerge, and what their attitudes will be, and why and how they might move for independence from Earth, or have conflicts with each other. We can't possibly cover them all, but I hope it's given you some food for thought. The moon's been less popular in fiction in recent decades, and a lot of the previous stories are a bit dated. So hopefully we've got a clearer and more updated view now on such future bases. It's an important topic, and one we've been neglecting, in my opinion. I'm glad to see that changing, largely I imagine because folks like SpaceX have managed to make it seem more plausible that bases on the moon might happen in our lifetime, not as it often seemed around the turn of the century, as a thing that would just keep getting pushed back another 20 years. One of the best of these new novels is our book of the month, Artemis, by Andy Weir, author of the novel The Martian, from which the blockbuster movie was adapted. I loved the film and the book, in large part because the science was good, and the protagonist and his challenge felt realistic and empathetic, and they didn't need a high body count or mustache-twirling villains to make it exciting, sadly a rarity in fiction. Artemis is his second novel, set on the moon, and again we get immersed in a compelling character who solves their problems with cleverness, and who makes mistakes like a real person. Though there is more classic action in it, and it is exciting, it doesn't feel like some implausible world-shaking story. Good choice in the narrator for the audiobook, too. Rosario Dawson gives a good performance, and some extra life and flavor to the protagonist, Jasmine Jazz Bashara. The novel varies a lot from The Martian, but keeps that focus on good hard science and technology. And unsurprisingly, I have a soft spot for sci-fi authors who clearly do their research. This is Weir's second novel, and I'm hoping for many more. If you'd like a copy of Artemis, just use my link in this episode's description, audible.com/Isaac, or text Isaac to 500-500. And right now, for a limited time, you can get 3 months of Audible for just $6.95 a month. That's more than half off the regular price, and you can give yourself the gift of a number of great audiobooks for passing the time this winter. An Audible membership is also a great gift for other folks. You get to give someone a book, but don't have to worry if they like it, since they can pick out or exchange for ones they like. Before we get to the upcoming schedule, I did a couple of interviews this last week over on the Non Sequitur show and with my friend Paul on Facebook. We had some very fascinating discussions, and I'll link those in the video description below. Next week, we'll look at another common staple of sci-fi, freezing people for voyages or putting them in stasis or suspended animation in sleeper ships. The week after that, we'll discuss a topic that is very uncommon in sci-fi, but more common in fantasy, as we at last return to the Megastructure series to look at building artificial flat or dish-shaped planets. For alerts when those and other episodes come out, make sure to subscribe to the channel and hit the notifications bell. And if you enjoyed this episode, hit the like button and share it with others. Until next time, thanks for watching and have a great week.